And then you've got these words like anatta, sunyata, emptiness, sunyata, nibbana, words that have no definition. They all, one of my favorite quotes is from, there's the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. And so I started contemplating this. What is the unborn? If something unborn, can I imagine it? Can I create some kind of image of unborn, uncreated, unformed? And then you observe, mindfulness observes, my mind goes blank. I can't think, I can't create an image. The closest you can is like a zero or something. But that's symbolic, you see. So just being able to observe the unborn, uncreated, it stops your thinking mind. Because you can't conceive it. You can't create it into any form. It's formless. But it's certainly recognizable to be aware of, like when you stop trying to figure it out, and then there's just awareness that has no form to it. But it's certainly conscious and intelligent. It's not, you don't go become a zombie or a ghost. And you're alert. Your mind is bright rather than dull and stupid. So then it goes, there's the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned. If there was not, there'd be no escape from the born, the created, the formed, the conditioned. There'd be no way out of it. We're stuck in the samsara. No possible way to get out of it. It's the hopeless despair of repeating the same things over and over again. And then it goes on, because there is the unborn, uncreated, unformed, unconditioned, there is the escape from the born, the created, the formed, the conditioned. Well, those two might be taking the unborn and born, or created, uncreated, and created. But that helps you to discern it here. What's unborn, uncreated? And then your mind, your thinking mind, packs up. So then you can often think, oh, rubbish, I can't ignore it, it just makes me confused. Or, if you bear with that, eventually you're kind of sustaining this awareness around not knowing anything. And if you're patient with that, it will lead you to a very blissful state. It's unborn, uncreated. You didn't create bliss out of some practice or some kind of intentional. You can't imagine. You might have views about it, but you can't create this unborn. But you can recognize it, and this is what mindfulness allows us to do. And this is the whole kind of magnificent of Buddha's teaching. It's so simple, so accurate, but it goes by. People don't get it because we're very complicated. We're complicated personalities, and emotional needs, and karmas, and all that. It is to me very impressive that you're all here, willing to do this. Something in you has awakened to this Dhamma, and otherwise you wouldn't be here. And then that is something to trust. That's what brings you to this monastery. And because it's not easy life, and you've got to put up with all kinds of irritating situations, but it is a form that is deliberately constructed to help us. And it holds, like I found, like, it holds, I tended to can't be very all of, you know, like, you know, idealistic and be scattered all over, you know, and just get so distracted and involved and caught up into so many options and opportunities that I realized early on I needed to be in a container that kept me from just going out all the time. And of course, here in Thailand, when I met Bunpo Chai, this is what I can, you know, this will probably help me, because otherwise, if I just try to do this all on my own, I'll probably just get, you know, the whole tendency, habit tendency was indulgence and distraction. And then, so living within this fixed vinaya structure, I didn't find it easy, you know, because I don't, you know, emotionally, I was used to doing what I want, but suddenly you're kind of held down and can't do that anymore. But the point is, you observe that frustration that comes from having something you hit against, you know, you have to, either you leave and say the hell with it, or you just conform within the structure, and it's a moral structure, so it's not meant to be a kind of tyranny or you know, you're not asked to do harmful acts or violent acts. It's just to not act on those emotions. So now it's like a, you know, in my monastic life, it's kind of holding within that. Now it's like it's just second nature. It's not like I'm trying to keep the rules and uptight around it and worry, but it's just like, you know, it's the way where I live. It's just ordinary. And then it gives you a sense of it, because it is a kind of blessing to us, to the world. You know, you really, like living in Europe for so long, you know, a Buddhist monk from Thailand going off and living in London sounds impossible, you know, from the way I would think, you know, because it's not a Buddhist country, and big international city and so forth. So but in all those years, I never had any, I mean, you know, there's never been any great problem from the external, from the government or the people there. And the four requisites have been abundant. And then the respect that people have. Even though a lot of people don't know what you are, there is a sense of this form, this samana form has maybe it's an archetype of sorts, you know, it has a resonating quality to it. So even in the countries like England or Italy or Portugal, you still see this kind of, even though people may not know what you are or what you're doing, they do have this sense of you're some kind of spiritual person or pilgrim on the path, and there are ways of trying to define you. But it's usually in a way that is quite respectful. So, you know, like this discerning the unborn and the born, then the thinking mind wants to say, oh, the unborn is better than the born. And then we get into, that's a criticism, isn't it? It's better. That's a critical point. Then you're thinking again. But the discerning, and this mindfulness then allows us to discern the unborn is like this, and the born is like this. Then we can use the born, the creative, the form, in terms of, you know, skillful means, rather than just blind reactivity, habitual reactions to life. So, like, Dhrumacharya, you know, he, when he saw this, then he, you know, he used to wonder why he started Wattapo. You know, he could have, my idea was that, oh, if I had this insight, I would be off in some peaceful place. I don't want to bother with all this, the society and monks and nuns and all the problems that arise. And and then and I thought, Ajahn Chah, you know, out of compassion, was establishing you know, monasteries where I could go and listen and train with him. He didn't need it for himself, but he was, you know, just using his, the remainder of his life and his and the wisdom that he has to help other people to see the. And in Thailand, you know, where it is a Buddhist, is where Buddhism is so, you know, it's the dominant religion, and it's part of a culture. So Lungpa Cha was trying to educate the Thai people and say, look, you've got this decision tool that you're not using properly. So he used to scold the Thais all the time about all their superstitions and things and assumptions they have around Buddhism and so forth. And this is what I found so inspiring was, you know, here was somebody who actually, he was informing people in this country what actually is the Buddhist teaching and what is not. And he wasn't saying that you go to hell if you don't, you know, if you believe in ghosts and all this. And this is saying that this is, you know, to try to awaken people to discerning the value of Buddhism, because like an ancient religion like this gets, you know, over years becomes, you know, so many additions, you know, it kind of absorbs other things, and so much of it becomes even non-Buddhist. And that's like Buddhadasa in Sun Mo, same thing. When I was a young monk, these were two powerful teachers in Thailand that were really clear and saying, you know, this is the path, this is the what the Buddha taught. The rest might be cultural or superstition, animism or whatever, but he was very, you know, very direct and oftentimes very fierce with people, you know, about that. Because he wants out of compassion to get people to appreciate what they have rather than just, I'm a Buddhist and, you know, I don't really see what that, you know, the gift that they have, that maybe they ignore and don't see, you know, see it as just part of a cultural habit. And that's where, you know, because Thai Buddhism really, because you know, Thailand was never colonized by European country. So Thai Buddhism, when I first came to Thailand, you know, it was, Westerners just didn't know much about it. And then because it had never been colonized, you know, they never, you know, hardly any monks could speak English or things like this. So Westerner, non-Thai people coming into Thailand found it quite difficult, because where Burma was the most logical place to go back in 1960, because the Burmese had been a British colony, there's a lot of cultural exchange and a lot of people spoke English in Burma, and there were meditation teachers, and Sri Lanka also. And but when I came to Thailand, and Burma was shut off, couldn't go there anymore. I would have gone to Burma, actually. But the government there, you know, became a real tyranny, and then you couldn't, I mean, I think they'd give you a visa for a week back in 1966. that was it. But so Thailand, you know, was the logical place to go. You know, and but hardly any Westerners knew anything about Thai Buddhism then, which has changed now, is it? And so what impressed me was you hear certain like expatriate people living in Bangkok for having views and opinions about Thai Buddhism, but from what I could tell, you know, even before I understood the Thai language, you have these teachers like Buddhadasa or Lumpa Cha, and they were teaching the real, you know, the direct approach. No mucking about, you know, it was. And so, what better, what more could you ask, you know? You didn't have, they didn't ask you to believe in all the, you know, the cultural conditions and that. So it was easy, you know, I found it easy to adapt on that level because I wasn't, you know, dealing with a lot of cultural things that didn't mean anything to me. I was dealing with suffering and its causes and the sensation all the time in my life at Bhopal. And then I could, you know, I could use the traditional form and the Thai culture, you know, as it affected me. I could be aware of it rather than just dismiss it or blindly follow, or, you know, just go along with everything without question or, you know, forming my own opinions. I, you know, the direction was always observing rather than just putting up with things or going along with things or feeling you had to conform out of to be accepted and things like that. You can feel much more sense of this is something I can do, something of value.
Speaking of anatta and dwelling on letting go and these sorts of things, can you give some words of suggestions about self-discipline within that, without getting, you know, too worried about like, I really gotta be a good chanter, I really gotta wear my robe, right? I see there's some importance there, but maybe you could talk about the importance of self-discipline as the path to not self.
Well, like the important thing is to be aware of, you know, how you take the idea of self-discipline can be a form of tyranny. You know, I should be, and one can be caught up in ideas, I'm not disciplined enough, or you're trying too hard to be perfect, whatever. Or you've got views of, oh, that rubbish, you know, it's not important, just mindfulness is enough, there's some, that's the other extreme. So then but my suggestion is observe. Whether, you know, you think it's rubbish, it's like this, or you think, you know, it's obsessive and makes you more tense and worried about everything, then, you know, you're observing, this is grasping this by becoming obsessed with the form. But like in the early years, you have to learn the form so you can let it go. You have to, you know, you can't just, like, you know, about you learn how to the structure around you. That takes a certain amount of determination and discipline and surrender to it. But that's not the end. It's merely you getting so that it becomes something you can let go of because it's you've internalized it rather than just grasp the external form. Then you become more aware of how Theravada Buddhism affects you, or Vinaya, or there's various views and interpretations about what Buddha really taught, or how you should keep the Vinaya and things like this. So you come across, in your life, there's so many views and opinions, but The important thing is to observe, like I determined, I'm just going to do it the way they do Wattva poem. Because that seemed to, you know, that's what everybody agreed to there. That's what Ajahn Chah encouraged in the monk, so do it that way. And so then I developed that. But then other people come along and saying, "Oh, the Vinaya really says you shouldn't do this, should do that," and then you get into arguments about it and doubts. But that's not the point, you know, to get it perfect, but to get used to the container, so that I call it like internalizing it, like when you learn to play a musical instrument. You know, you have to go through boring practice routines, da 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 da, da over and over. Or learning to dance, you know, you've got to repeat these steps and over and over until they internalize, they come naturally. And so you know, so then you, after a while, they just become the way you know, you don't have to think about what string do I pluck. It just, you know, on a deeper level and just on the material level. And that comes through practice, then, rather than through, you know, it's not something you're born with and know immediately from the day one how to play the piano, unless you're Mozart. And then and that's what I always felt with Lumpa Cha was, you know, he seemed so at ease with it, within the container of the Vinaya. And it didn't seem a struggle, or he was completely relaxed within the structure, and it was just natural. So you didn't get the impression he was keeping any rules at all. You know, it wasn't like that was. And then, like going to England the first time, and I could see he could size up situations and adapt to particular contingencies that arose that he might never encounter here in Thailand. But because it was done through mindfulness, rather than through, it's got to be like this or, you know, it's wrong. So it's interesting to see somebody like that who's so admired here in this country. You know, we spent the week before we came to London in Bangkok, and then all these people coming to see him and bowing, and everybody, the Thai culture, it's so polite, so graceful, so, you know, devoted. And I thought, that's not how it's going to be in London. So we go from Bangkok to London, and then I was really impressed the way he'd tune in, he'd observe how the English did things, or he was quite interested in getting to know. You know, he doesn't try to make everybody do it his way, but he had a certain kind of grace and you know, greatly admired, even though he couldn't speak English. People could, you know, people that came really developed kind of overnight a kind of trust and respect for him. It's a years ago, I remember that Tham Sang Pet and Ajahn Chah and I were walking on top, you know, the hill, and he was saying, "Sumedho, you must be confused, because the Dhamma is all about letting go and Vinaya is about clinging." And so, I do find that a paradox, actually. And so, he said, "Well, when you figure that one out, you'll be okay." And this is an important thing, you know, because it's that, like, form is this way. Like, Vinaya is all about form, containment, restriction. And Vinaya and Dhamma is about letting go of everything. You know, no form. Unborn, uncreated. And yet, when the Buddha was, before he passed on, you know, Ananda said, what did we do without our teacher? You're gone. Who designed you, Dhamma and Vinaya? So, and he didn't say just Dhamma, he said Vinaya also. Now this, I find it like in the West, people aren't really interested in the Vinaya, but in the Dhamma. This is one of the problems living there, I found, was they love Dhamma, but they don't, you know, the Vinaya is something that they, you know, they go along with, but they don't really understand it, or really even some, you know, find even five precepts a struggle. Well, I think you don't even need five precepts, you know. Dhamma is about letting go, being free, and so forth. So it, you know, there's that. That's what people love, is Dhamma. Because it is, it's beautiful. It has this sense of not being bound and contained and restricted and bound into forms and rules and traditions and religions and all these things that people are very critical of now in the West. And this idea of freedom, express yourself, do what you want, is very attractive. Option, but then where does it go, you know, where does it stop? And so then the form, you know, you've got this, and this is a traditional form, it's not a form that is up for option, you know, for negotiation, you know, I don't like these rules, I must change them kind of thing. It's like when you join the club, you have to, this is the categorical imperative, you know, this is what you expect. They're not negotiable. So then in some way that makes our life much more easy, because if we endlessly try to negotiate on that level, there's no end to it. It's just always this person's view and that person's feelings, and we just go on and on and create endless problems with each other and with the tradition. And with various individual preferences and ideas. So, what we do, you get accused sometimes of being old-fashioned, or, you know, I've been accused of being attached to tradition, of being, you know, here I'm supposed to be free from attachment, and Ajahn Sumedho is attached to the Thai forest tradition. Some people think that. So, and that might how they might see it, you know, in the way they think and interpret life. But my experience has been I see it as a kind of precision tool if used properly. And that's why I don't want to change it. You know, I don't want to make it British or American or, you know, Western Buddhism. And it's got its point. It's a tradition that has managed to survive up to this moment. And so it must have a power within it. Otherwise, it would have been changed all over the place. Like in Buddhism, you know, like in England. You've got every variation on the theme of Buddhism there. And if you don't like this, there's other options, you know, other groups. And there's Zen, and then there's Tibetan, and there's modern psychotherapeutic Buddhism, and Vipassana without Buddha, and things like this. There's everything, all kinds of alternatives and options on the theme. So, you know, this is why, you know, I feel very committed to try to keep this within the the tradition to make it available for those who see, you know, want to use it, who see it value. Because there's so many other, yeah, I see, you know, like the Vipassana movement in the States is, you know, that, you know, has a certain, you know, the certain admirable things about it, but it doesn't have that precision to it. It doesn't cut clearly through the ego. And if you, you know, like they're talking about the three fetters, and that it's really these three fetters, and you can come from very good intentions, wanting to, you know, the best for everybody in the world, and practice to, as a bodhisattva, to help all sentient beings. But it still can be operating from the three fetters. So in this way, you're actually going to the fetters, the obstructions, right off, right from the beginning. Not to annihilate them, but to understand them, so that they're not confusing you or blinding you. And once you really see through those, because they're artificial things. Like sexual desire is not artificial, it's part of nature, the nature of the body. Or anger, self-preservation, all this is part of the package of being a human being, being a mammal, learning to survive. It's not created by human society. But the first three fetters are all creations of society, of, you know, white languages and cultures and tribal people, Muslims, Hindus, Christians, a whole lot. You know, these are created by human thought, human ideas. They're not given to us in nature. Your body's a natural condition. You know, so it's not, human body is a part of me. Consciousness is natural. You don't create consciousness through culture. So you've got consciousness and the body as just part of nature. This realm here, this earth, this planet, the trees and the mountains and the oceans and so forth, and all the animals and the mosquitoes and the birds and whatnot, we're all involved in this sense realm of feeling, natural conditions that is what we call nature. It's not created by any individual. But the self is created by human ignorance and desire, and culture and social identities and thinking. Thinking is a creation. So then, like in the West, you find they develop the thinking process to a high level, the logic and reason and the intellect, using these various forms of intelligent thinking, reasonable thinking, logical thinking, scientific, which is very impressive, but it's still created by human beings that have not awakened to Dhamma. They might be brilliant, you know, on that level, but it's still Sakya Dipi Sila Bhatta Paramahansa Vichikita. So in this direct approach of the Buddha, you know, he gave very clear directions, you know, do this. So it's, you know, you're not trying to attack the ego or get rid of your sense of self, you're understanding it. And that understanding is not ego. You know, this which is aware of my ego is not ego. But I can't, if I say I'm aware or I'm mindful or something, then it can become ego. So you don't say anything, but you recognize, you discern this state of just being present and in this wide spectrum of awareness, where it's not concentrated on any object, but just open and receptive in the moment. even though that's a natural state, but we, you know, our societies tend to always make us focus on something, to, you know, to engage in something around us, some object. So we, you know, we don't really appreciate this mindful sati-sampajanya. We have samadhi, you know, like we learn to concentrate the mind on a reading or on some object. But to just not be concentrated on an object, but concentrated in this more wide open way is sati-sampajanya. And that's where the discerning ability of panya operates. Now that's important. It's like the thinking mind is a critical function. So it says this is good, this is bad, this is right, this is wrong, this is higher, lower. But this is, but this sati-sampajanya panya is not critical. So you use this discerning. It knows the difference between self and non-self. There's a knowing. Self is like this, non-self, anatta is like this. Or worldly attachment, samsara is like this, nibbana is like this. You discern the difference. And it's not saying nibbana is better, but nibbana is like this. And then you can see, like, samsara is, if you attach to samsara, then you get whirled away into the momentum of those cycles. So when you begin to see the result of being just being heedless and caught into that, then you tell, there's no point in doing that anymore, I know better. Because sometimes in monastic life we want to be good monks, and we have ideals of being, you know, content with little and keeping the Vinaya properly, and we have, these are ideals of monastic life. And then, you know, then you can be, sometimes feel, you know, hopeless because you can't live up to these ideals all the time. You can't be as good as you imagine you should be. So we can take the ideal of bhikkhu life, of monasticism, and attach to the ideal of it, and then create misery for ourselves because we feel guilty about a greed for food or sexual desire or anger or jealousy and things like this. We shouldn't have that. I'm not a very good bhikkhu because I'm jealous or greedy. And I mean, then we create these judgments about ourselves. Or, because I remember in the old days, some of the Western monks used to idealize the bhikkhu to the point where they couldn't actually do it anymore because they were always failing. They could never, you know, be as good as they felt they should be. So they gave up. Where, I could see, you know, I can't, I'd like to be the best and a really good monk and have unlimited compassion for all beings. I mean, on the ideal level, this is beautiful stuff. But in the Vipaka Kamala moment, sometimes it isn't like that at all. It's like, you know, a very selfish, very negative attitude, feelings arise, fears. But this is where, you know, your all conditions are impermanent, and so you realize everything part, you know, is good for the will, whether it's good or bad, high or low, ideal or not. And so then you find your confidence in this awareness as you investigate.